boy and girl. The sky is blue, the fields are green, and laughter is the language of the world. Then I wake and all I see is a world full of people in need. Tell me why.
Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, January 14, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389-pound. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions, that's plural questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, we'll pick up where we left off last week, is going to be in the Gospel of John, chapter 10, picking up in verse 22, and we're going to read to 42, verse 22 through 42. Last week, we read 1 through 22, where the Lord told us that he was the Good Shepherd. Okay, we'll pick up in verse 22. And it was at Jerusalem, the feast of dedication, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Then came the Jews round about him and said unto him, How long doest thou make us to doubt? If thou be the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus answered them, I told you, and you believe not. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. But ye believe not, because ye are not of my sheep. As I said unto you, my sheep hear my voice, I know them, and they follow me. And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. My Father, which gave them me, is greater than all, and no man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one. Then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, Many good works have I showed you from my Father. For which of those works do you stone me? The Jews answered him, saying, For a good work we stone thee not, but for blasphemy, and because thou being a man, maketh thyself God. Jesus answered them, Is it not written in your law, I said, ye are gods? If he called them gods unto whom the word of God came, and the scriptures cannot be broken, say ye of him whom the Father hath sanctified and sent into the world, thou blasphemest, because I said, I am the Son of God? If I do not the works of my Father, believe me not. But if I do, though you believe not me, believe the works, that ye may know and believe that the Father is in me and I in him. Therefore they sought again to take him, but he escaped out of their hands, and went away again beyond Jordan into a place where John at first baptized, and there he abode. And many resorted unto him and said, John did no miracle, but all things that John spake of this man were true, and many believed on him there. Okay, that was John, Gospel of John, chapter 10, 22 through 42. And we'll pick up on chapter 11 next Monday. All right. Anyway, just real quick, a point on the reading of the scriptures that we do here in the beginning of our program. We've, in the past, we've considered starting off with a prayer. And I think it was last week or the week before, someone recently was asking about starting things off with a prayer. We have decided to start things off with just a reading of the piece of the gospel instead of prayer. When we read that, we're in prayer. And also, of course, we get the gospel message. And we don't get lost into vain repetitions or vain requests or statements concerning God. So anyway, for that reason, we read scriptures instead of saying a prayer. Okay, we don't particularly have any topic for tonight, but I've been working on some things. Last week, Jen and I finished up on the information that we're going to be sent to the Senate probably this week. I mean, it's all ready to go. I think maybe tomorrow or the next day we'll print it out and send it out to all involved. But I'd like to read it. It's extremely short. It's literally, not even 1.5 pages. We'll say 1.5 pages. And, of course, the words are spread out a bit, being papers that we're filing with the court. Now, we filed informations before. And, by the way, before I continue, Jan, am I still coming in okay?
Yeah, you sound better now than you did earlier.
Okay, great. Well, that's good news. How about that song? That song sounded really bad. Did it sound terrible to you?
Yeah, it was all chopped up.
Yeah, I wonder what that's all about. Maybe we should call them up and see if there's anything. Maybe we got too many songs up there, too, because we do have a lot of stuff, a lot of songs we don't even really use often anyway. All right, anyway, this is an information. We're going to be filing under our case number up here in Albany, Northern District, where we have a case open for the sole purpose of being under the auspices of the court. And so we'll file this paper up there in the Northern District. And it is addressed, it's an information filed under that case number, and it's addressed to the 116th United States Congress. Copies sent to Senate President Mike Pence and President Pro Tempore Chuck Grassley for distribution to all senators and restoration. Now, I'm thinking maybe we probably will send a copy to the Congress, too, you know, the representatives, not just the senators. Okay, the purpose of this information is to notify the United States Senate of the error for correction concerning the three-fifths rule, also known as the filibuster or the nuclear option. This information is directed to President Mike Pence and President Pro Tempore Chuck Grassley for distribution to the other 99 senators. Also carbon copied President Trump, Chief Justice Roberts, and Acting Attorney General Matthew Whittaker. And again, I might add, a couple of people in the Congress for distribution there too. Not that they're going to obey us, which they should, of course, but we're bringing the law to their attention, what we the people permitted them to do, and if we didn't give them permission to do it, they don't have it. It's that simple. Anyway, it's building a case, and at some point in time, when we the people step up and get educated, then we will be able to make a difference and make changes. But only then can we take control and power, the authority that the grassroots, the people should have from the grassroots level. But we don't have. And the only reason we don't have it is because of our ignorance. Nothing more. If the people weren't ignorant, they wouldn't be able to resist us. We would come down on them so hard and disrupt and require repair of all the errors of their way and be relentless about it. And they wouldn't be able to turn one way or the other without having to deal with us if we, the people, were educated. But we're not. Speak to myself first, but I'm in the process of education. And hopefully people are becoming educated. They're taking our course, and we get the book out, taking that. And as most of you know, I've been ill for about a month, a pretty bad case of the flu, and then whatever came after that, I have no clue, but... bedridden for 2 weeks, and I didn't do anything for 4 weeks, and absolutely nothing. And that really kind of killed me in a sense, because I could have had a lot more accomplished. I probably could have had the course done if I had the past month to be able to spend, over the holidays finishing off the course and finishing off the book. But that didn't happen, so I'm working on it, and I'm working as diligently as I can on it, and hopefully I'll get it soon. I don't want to give any dates because things come up, and my time goes this way or that way, and... hard to get to it. But anyway, the key thing here is knowledge. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, as Jefferson said, forget about it. It's not going to happen. You can't have it. So we all need to be working to spread the word, educating ourselves and getting other people to educate themselves. I get a lot of email and different things from people, videos, some things, I've even people have sent me books over the years. Different websites, and just information on, the construction, the fraudulent construction of law, the man on the land stuff, we have to go establish ourselves and get our standing correct and come in and do all these kind of different exercises, click our heels and be transported into the land of liberty. Of course, that's not going to happen. But anyway, I did get educated in a lot of this stuff, and I spent a lot of time, wasted a lot of time, but maybe not. Maybe I didn't really waste my time because I understand what they're doing and how they're doing it by getting lost in that stuff. So maybe for a lot of people it is important to kind of understand that. But I think it's much more important to understand the law, understand the truth, understand our founding fathers, understand our founding documents, what true law is, what is positive law, what is the law of the land, what is the difference between equity and law, You know, this is all extremely important. And if we have knowledge of the enemy, and we could get lost in that knowledge, thinking we have to exercise those things, why participate in the fraud, you know? But anyway, we can get lost in that. And again, I don't want to say that it's unimportant. I think to some degree we should understand those things. But we should be spending more time in the things of substance, in the things of truth, in the things that can and will empower we the people. But we need a large percentage of people, you know, to come to the knowledge of truth to really take back control. The question might be, what is a large number of people? Well, I don't think we're talking millions, so we're talking well under 1% of the population, well under it. But whatever that number is, I don't know. But we know that we need 15,000 people with knowledge across the United States just to seize control of the courts, you know, which we the people should have control of the courts on the grassroots level. Not from any central point, because then that would be just what they're doing. You know, the people have to decide on their own grassroots level. But before they decide things and be able to do things, they have to have knowledge. So again, it gets back to understanding and having the knowledge of these things that will give us the ability to have government by consent. All right, I just wanted to break away with some of those things, but let's get back to this paper. We read the first page, which was, you know, who it's addressed to and the purpose of the information and so on. And we start, the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 3 states, each senator shall have one vote. The vice president of the United States shall be president of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided, which confirms majority rule. The Senate, by rule, cannot rewrite law, nor can the Senate rest in the precedence of corrupt republics before us. And by the way, you know, I didn't go through the paper you sent me back, Jan, yet to make the corrections. That word precedence, were you able to figure out how to spell that? Because I couldn't find that anyways.
Yeah, I thought it was spelled correctly.
Yeah, but it shows up on my word correction, you know, as an error. And I couldn't find it in any dictionary. I did go online, and I ran, you know, a precedence on something, and that's where I got the spelling from. But when I ran that in any dictionary, it doesn't come out right. It says it's spelled, it doesn't recognize the word.
Yeah, I checked it online and checked okay. I didn't check dictionary.
Yeah, it's strange on that word. Okay, anyway, rest in the precedence. P-R-E-C-D-E-N-C-E, P-R-E. Actually, I got P-R-E-S-I-D-E-N-C-E. Anyway, we're going to have to work on that word and make sure we got it spelled right. Okay. Rest in the precedence of corrupt republics before us. These facts are clarified by Article 5, which states, no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. The definition of equal suffrage stands as follows. Each voter is equal in its influence upon the results to vote of every other elector. So it's an even vote, majority rule. Therefore, to hold a majority, to hold a majority's votes as having more, let me read that. Therefore, to hold a minority's votes as having more influence than the majority would deprive the majority their equal suffrage and lawful rule, and thereby an obstruction of justice. Via Article 1, Section 5, Clause 2, we the people gave authority to each house to determine the rules of its proceedings. The purpose of a rule is to establish uniform procedures in order to maintain order. Rules are not law. Congress cannot change laws via rules. Consequently, all rules and practices which are repugnant to the Constitution are null and void. Thus, the Senate's three-fifth rule, also known as filibuster, is a nullity because it seeks to change the law of majority rule and equal suffrage that we the people ordained and established. By our prerogative and to prevent congressional abuse by a majority, we the people, via Article 5, required two-thirds of both houses in order to propose amendments to this Constitution, and three-quarters to ratify. Via Article 1, Section 5, Clause 2, we required the concurrence of two-thirds to expel a member for bad behavior. Via Article 1, Section 7, we required two-thirds of both houses to defeat a president's rejection of a bill. And finally, via Article 2, Section 2, Clause, Section 2, Clause, I don't have a clause number in there. Article 2, Section 2, Clause, I'll put a question mark. I got to come get that.
Yeah. You didn't have that filled in, John.
Okay. Did you look it up and put it in on the
No,
correction?
I didn't. I just made
a note.
Question mark in there for you.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Finally, via Article 2, Section 2, don't know what clause it's in, the President, with the advice and consent of two-thirds of the Senate, has the power to make treaties. Everything else is majority rule. Remember, if we didn't give them the authority, they don't have it. They can't change the rules. And this has been something that's been frustrating Justice. It's been frustrating President Trump. It's been frustrating me. And I'm sure many other people, that these people make these rules to do what they do. And if you go look this up and start getting involved in this, these are Parliament rules. We're not Parliament. We're not England. We didn't make any reference to them. We didn't refer to their rules in any way, shape, or form, which are very distorted rules in some places. They're made in order to take control of certain processes. Anybody that was a committeeman in the past, under the fraudulent way that they're running things, unelected committeeman, thinking you're elected, but, you know, really, you're appointed. And anybody that had been involved, after a while, you see all the evil stuff these people do with their rules and how they've taken overseas control and prevent anyone from having any say whatsoever. It's what the top says and the bottom must believe. And after a while, as you figure things out and you get frustrated enough, you get depressed about it, you say, I'm out of here, and you leave. And they go through lots of committeemen that way. So they're always appointing new committeemen, trying to fill the ranks. And they can't even fill the ranks. But in any event, you know, we need to take the power back and rewrite the rules. We've done that already. We've done that conference up in Kingston, New York, which was the first capital of New York and was moved up to Albany. But anyway, we had our conference up there, and we got together all of the real elected committeemen. Goodness, I think it was about 30 or 40 of us. It wasn't a lot of us, but enough to take over the entire state. That's all we really need. If we can, and then that's when we took it to court. We did lose it in court because, of course, the judge decided to make a rule. Well, we were ignorant, really ignorant back in those days as far as how the law works, and of course, maintained the status quo. Okay, back to the paper here, just to finish off. I think I got two powers, mixed treaties, everything else is majority rule. Okay, in conclusion, if we wanted to give the minority the destructive three-fifths rule, also known as the filibuster or the nuclear option, we would have ordained and established it. And since we didn't, there can be no rulemaking to change a rule of law. Such actions are an obstruction of justice because it disregards the will of we the people. Therefore, the Senate is to cease from exercising power that we did not give them. Okay, so that's the paper we're going to be filing, serving on to the Senate, probably this week. And once it's filed up and put up on the website, we'll send an email out, maybe in the newsletter, letting you know where it's located at. Again, we're going to send it to, of course, the President will get a copy. Chief Justice Roberts will get a copy. Acting Attorney General Matthew Whittaker will get a copy. And we're probably going to copy the Congress, the representative, people's representatives, as well as the Senate. Okay, let's see what else we have here. Did Brent get in yet, by the way? I didn't see him in here yet. I see Gerard's in. So, okay. A couple of things I might want to go through. You know, I'm working on Chapter 7 in the course, and I had some knowledge about Jefferson on slavery, and I'm finding a lot more. This man was relentless. Every time this man got power, he was relentless on trying to free the slaves, on trying to change the law. You know, I get so upset with these, you know, people who write, you know, about Jefferson in general, or people who are do it for a living, and they talk about him being an enigma, okay, because, you know, he wrote the Declaration of Independence, wrote about liberty, and yet he himself had slaves. Let me just read a couple of paragraphs here or there that it's going into the book. You know, it hasn't been proofed yet, so we may have some, you know, distorted writing here or there, improper English or whatever you want to call it. But I'd like to read just a few chapters here or there of what I pulled out of history, and found it very interesting. But anyway, it starts off, I start off with one paragraph this way. If you want to destroy the heart and soul of America, you must first assassinate the reputation of Thomas Jefferson. And by the way, as I went on in this, and I'm still researching some of this stuff, you know, Jefferson was called the founding father apostle because he was so godly and focused on righteousness. And I'd never heard that before, but that's very interesting. Anyway, reading on. You must first assassinate the reputation of Thomas Jefferson. Ever since I can remember, I heard destructive statements such as, and this is quoted right off of the Internet on some page, and I gave a reference to it, Jefferson's remarkable declaration was an enigma. He proclaimed that, and listen to the lies they got in here, he proclaimed that all men were created equal and possessed natural rights. However, as Jefferson wrote those words, he owned slaves whose natural rights were not respected nor protected. Not long after he wrote the Declaration of Independence, his views on race became the basis for the movement to deport freed blacks to Africa or the West Indies. I mean, come on now. Nothing could be further from the truth. Where did this guy get this? But anyway, they go on. Jefferson bought and sold slaves throughout his adult life. Another lie. Jefferson never bought, nor he ever sold a slave. He inherited all the slaves he had, and he seeked three times, two times to the legislature and once as a governor, and then other places too, where he tried to be able to free his slaves, because in Virginia, there was a law that prevented the emancipation of slaves. If you wanted to get rid of your slave, you had to sell him, and he refused to sell his slaves. That's why Jefferson owned slaves. And he did, every step of the way, he tried to turn away from this. Okay, anyway, let me go back. However, as Jefferson wrote those words, he owned slaves whose natural rights were not respected nor protected. And he did have a lot of respect for his slaves, and he did protect them. Of course, you know, they didn't really, as far as anyone else is concerned, couldn't be acknowledged as having rights. But if you read some of the things that people wrote about him and his slaves, he had a very good relationship with them. And there's some really good stories. People should read this book, The Real Thomas Jefferson. You can get that at nccs.net, The Real Thomas Jefferson. Unbelievable book. And the whole book is about The Real Thomas Jefferson, because almost every word in there, 98% of the words in there, is coming out of his letters, you know, communications with other people, and so on. So they're all documentations of his opinions, thoughts, and ideas. Okay. Jefferson bought and sold slaves throughout his adult life. That's a lie. He even sent bounty hunters after runaway slaves. Another lie. Some Christian writers, such as David Barton, I wonder why they went after him, huh? Claimed that Virginia law prevented Jefferson from freeing his slaves. However, this is not true. That's a lie. Okay? And let us not forget these people's most useful tool, claiming sexual deviancy against their victims. You can find a credible argument in support of Jefferson's character and give witnesses of where these lies came from by the people who knew Jefferson in the book, The Real Thomas Jefferson, Chapter 18, titled A Season of Slander. So when I was putting this together and I went back and started to, because I'd read that chapter before, and I was looking through it and I wanted to try to extract some information from there and put it into my book and, of course, give credit to where it came from. But there was so much. People should go read that entire chapter. It'll just blow you away. A Season of Slander. And this whole thing with his quote-unquote sexual deviancies and having a relationship with a slave who claims to, you know, who apparently or is reported that one woman had his children. This all started on his second run as president. And we even know the individual who started this. As a matter of fact, it was an individual who was unjustly imprisoned. And one of the first acts that Jefferson did was to have that man freed. And yet this guy went out and wrote all these things and so on and so forth. Very interesting story, and how Jefferson dealt with this, extremely interesting. Totally, he just ignored it. Just ignored it all. But anyway, A Season of Slander, it's Chapter 18, The Real Thomas Jefferson. You can get the book at nccs.net. It's very cheap. And it's even cheaper if you buy, blocks of books. You buy three or four or five books, which you can get maybe the real George Washington, the real Benjamin Franklin, the real Thomas Jefferson, and The Making of America. Those four books particularly is what I would suggest for people to buy and read, because they're just fascinating. But you get them even a lot cheaper if you buy a bulk of books. And cheap, when I'm talking cheap, I mean cheap, you know. You could buy cases of a particular book for $5 a piece, you know, if you buy a whole case. All right, anyway. There was one thing I wanted to read here. If I can find it. I think I'm coming up on it. Not there. All right, maybe this is it here. I think this is the paragraph. The first act of Jefferson's political career, as noted earlier, was an attempt to make it legal for slave owners in Virginia to emancipate their slaves. That bill was rejected. He was called to go to the Virginia legislature, and he was called twice for that job, and he went twice. And both times, his first order of business, trying to change the law. That bill was rejected, as was the condemnation of slavery in his original draft of the Declaration of Independence. And I think I have part of that original draft. I know I had it and I lost it, and then I think I just found it. I had made a note with it somewhere else. Let me see if I got it real quick. No, I don't see it here. But if I can't find it, if I don't have it, because I'm reviewing all this stuff now, if I don't have it, I will try to go look it up and find the original draft of Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. I don't know if we can get a copy of the original draft, but we can get copies of different things that were pulled out. And this was a big thing that Jefferson was upset about, because they pulled out his thing on slavery. He wanted to create a nation without slavery. And they pulled it out because they knew it just wasn't going to fly. I with Jefferson, I agree, he should have went forward with it, and they should have suffered the loss of a few states and went on, and I'm sure we would have been blessed more as a nation. And I believe the curse, we've been cursed. We've gone through what we've gone through in the past 50 or 60 years or so, almost to the brink of destruction through this deep state, because of that sin of slavery in our Constitution. That was the sin that our founding fathers you know, went along with, and they shouldn't have. Okay, his labor in this caused finally met with some success in 1778 when he introduced a bill in the Virginia House of Delegates to prevent the further importation of slaves into the state. The proposal was approved, but he recognized that it only stopped the increase of the evil by importation, leaving to future efforts its final eradication. I think it's eradication. It was Jefferson's desire to open the way for this final eradication. The very next year, when his committee submitted their proposal for the revision of Virginia's legal code. However, he ascertained through conversations with his colleagues that the legislature was not yet prepared to consider such a progressive step, so he calculated another strategy. The bill on the subject of slaves was a mere digest of the existing laws respecting them without any intimation of the plan for future and general emancipation. It was thought better that this should be kept back and attempted only by way of amendment whenever the bill should be brought on. Let me see if I have this right. Yeah, I think we do. But when the bill did come up for debate, Jefferson was unable to get his amendment passed. It was found that the public's mind would not yet bear the proposition. Yet the day is not distant when it must bear and adopt it, he wrote, or worse will follow. Nothing is more certainly written in the books of fate that these people are to be free. Jefferson would be heard from again on this issue of slavery. Now it goes on, and let me jump up to another paragraph or two here, and we'll end it. The vast area between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River had long been claimed by several of the original states, but the recent cession of these claims placed the area under the control of Congress in early 1784. Jefferson was appointed chairman of the committee to settle the many land disputes which had risen and to prepare a plan for the government of this western region. Jefferson himself drafted the report, known to history as the Ordinance of 1784. According to one scholar, the plan ranked second in importance only to the Declaration of Independence among Jefferson's state papers. This document, which reprinted together with preliminary drafts, became the basis for the famous Northwest Ordinance of 1787, provided for the creation of a self-governing territories that would eventually be admitted to the Union on terms of full equality with the original states. It was a bold and brilliant concept, one that would ultimately have a tremendous influence on the westward expansion of the United States. But Congress rejected a very significant element in Jefferson's report on the western territories. He had included in the bill a clause barring slavery in any of these territories after the year of 1800, a measure which might have averted the Civil War. But this proposal was defeated by one vote. Jefferson lamented, "The voice of a single individual would have prevented this abominable crime from spreading itself over the new country. Thus we see the face of millions unborn hanging on the tongue of one man, and heaven was silent in that awful moment. But it is to be hoped it will not always be silent, and that, my friends, to the right of human nature, will in the end prevail." Let me see if I read this next paragraph. Well, we'll read it again. I'm still working on this. Yet he worried about what might have to take place before this victory, for rights of human nature could be secured. Jefferson had actually advocated this idea 8 years earlier. His proposed new Virginia Constitution contained a provision that any future colonies established from Virginia Western's domain would be free and independent of this colony and of all the world. Then he wrote, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. And he's talking about slavery and the rejection of the legislators to get rid of it. Okay? His justice cannot sleep forever. That considering numbers, nature, and natural means only, a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation is among possible events, and that it may become probable by supernatural inference, the Almighty has no attribute which can take side with us in such a contest. Always an optimist in the end, however, Jefferson noted the next year that the cause of emancipation was gaining daily recruits from the influx into office of young men grown and growing up. These have sucked in the principles of liberty, as it were, with their mother's milk, and it is to them I look with anxiously to turn the fate of this question. All right, I'm going to end there because, again, you know, I'm kind of working. This is the introduction that I'm writing, which is involved in this case with Jefferson on slavery, and we're going to, and talking about the delicate balance of power between the states, the people, and the federal. And but it's an introduction, ultimately, to our founding documents. And this is Chapter 7. Which is probably going to be broken up 7A, 7B, 7C, and 7D. 7A being the introduction, 7B. Before I had it broken down into different chapters, 7, 8, 9. But I think I'm going to bring it in one chapter and break it into sub-chapters in the main chapter. One on the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And then, of course, maybe the next chapter will deal with talking about the other amendments after the Bill of Rights. There's one other thing before we get onto other business. Last week, if I find this quickly, last week we talked a little bit about. The difference of the authorities and powers, the state powers and the people power, and of course there's a judicial power and there's presidential power, but I want to read out of the Federalist Papers, number 39, okay, just a couple of paragraphs out of it that very directly deals with the balance of power. And it's extremely important that we understand that there is a balance of power, and it is between the states, the people, and the federal. That's the three basic focus of this balance of power. So let me read this. Could any further proof, this is Federalist Papers number 39, this is written by Madison. You know, while all this was being written and debated and they had the Constitutional Convention and right up until they voted for the Constitution, Jefferson was overseas. He wasn't in the country at the time. I think he was in France, if I recall. And he had a position there representing, the states out there. And again, I think it was France. But he did have communications. He did collaborate with Madison, particularly with Madison. Madison wrote a lot of the Federalist Papers, but Madison also wrote a lot of the Anti-Federalists. Jefferson was an Anti-Federalist. He was upset with them choosing a name, calling themselves the Federalists, because he believed in a federal connection, government or power or authority over the states, in order to bring the states together. And so that's what he believed in, and but he wanted to make sure it was done properly. And when things were being brought together, they saw some problems in it, of course, and they repaired that. You know, I think this is where people get confused, that there's two constitutions, the Constitution of 1787 and the Constitution of 1789. and they say, oh, the Constitution of 1789 is the wrong one. That's the one we have. It's not the good one. We need to go back to the Constitution of 1787. And I read the debate on this and the argument. As a matter of fact, I think I covered pieces of this in the book. The debate and the argument, in order to make the repair, okay, because after they had, they came together at the convention and they made their argument and put everything together. Meanwhile, the Anti-Federalist Papers were taking, shape and coming to be. And five states immediately signed on to the Constitution, but the rest of them would not. Not until they repaired the problems that they saw in the original Constitution. The president, they felt, had too much power. They didn't have anything there on certain liberties that could not be affected, the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and so on. And this was a lot of their positions and their arguments, and the Constitution didn't cover that, and therefore they saw that we can very quickly fall right back into what we just left as a nation with England. And so the compromise was made and agreed upon that the change of the Constitution was not a change in any of the words. The change was in the addition, the amendments. It's called the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. And when we understand that the Constitution must be understood in light of the Bill of Rights, we can see the power and the authority of the Bill of Rights over the Constitution. Our rights cannot be violated by government. And we can see how it simply made all the corrections. You know, the Bill of Rights is a masterpiece paper. And it was written by Madison, and I'm trying to think of the other individual that was involved. He was also a collaborator with Jefferson. Jefferson was behind the Bill of Rights, no doubt about it. When you read through it, you can see it. But Madison was brilliant also. The more and more I look into Madison, he was almost as brilliant as Jefferson. I think he was a student of Jefferson, to be honest. They were really worked well together. A lot of people said that. But anyway, let me read this Federalist paper, a couple of paragraphs out of it. It's number 29, written by Madison to the people of the state of New York. Could any further proof be required of the Republican complexion of the system? The most decisive one might be found in its absolute prohibition of titles of nobility, both under the federal and the state governments, and in its expressed guarantee of a Republican form to each of the latter. But it was not sufficient, say the adversaries of the proposed Constitution, for the convention to adhere to the Republican form. They ought with equal care to have preserved the federal form, which regards the Union as a confederacy of sovereign states, instead of which they have framed a national government which regards the Union as a consolidation of the states. And it asked by what authority this bold and radical innovation was undertaken. The handle which has been made of this objection requires that it should be examined with some precision. And, of course, the next paragraph lays it out and makes the correction, and we do become a confederacy. We have never lost that. We are a confederacy of sovereign states. Next paragraph. According to the provisions of most of the constitutions, again, as well as according to the most respectable and received opinions on the subject, the members of the judiciary department are to retain their office by the firm tenure of good behavior. You know, in the entire history of the United States, as far as I've searched for this, maybe it's happened somewhere, but I just don't know about it, but judges don't seem to ever be removed for having bad behavior. And we the people know how to do that. We indict them. We correct them. They don't correct them. We tell them to get out of town, or we'll indict them. Because, again, bad behavior is resistance and rejection of the Constitution. That's what bad behavior is, as far as this is concerned. And so they retain their offices by the firm tenure of good behavior. Now, so that's one power. The House of Representatives will derive its power from the people of America. And the people will be represented in the same proportion and on the same principle as they are in the legislature of a particular state. So far, the government is national, not federal. Then he goes on. The Senate, on the other hand, will derive its power from the states as political and co-equal societies. This is the balance of power. This makes so much sense. The more I read this over and over, it just is so full of common sense. As political and co-equal societies. And these will be represented on the principles of equality in the Senate, as they now are in the existing Congress. So far, the government is federal and not national. The executive power will be derived from a very compound source. The immediate election of the president is to be made by the states in their political characters. The votes allotted to them are to be compound ratio, which considers them partly as distinct and co-equal societies, partly as unequal members of the same society. The eventual election, again, is to be made by that branch of legislature, which consists of the national representatives. But in this particular act, they are to be thrown into the form of individual delegations from so many distinct and co-equal body politic. From this aspect of the government, it appears to be a mixed character, presenting at least as many federal as national features. The difference between a federal and a national government as it relates to the operation of the government is supposed to consist in this, that in the former, the powers operate on the political bodies composing the Confederacy in their political capacities. In the latter, on the individual citizens composing the nation in their individual capacities. So, you know, again, we are both national and we are also individual. Well, let me see, national and will be a confederacy. States political power, a lot of them, features, difference, federal and national. So we're federal and national. We have both parts of government collectively. Now, unfortunately, that's not true anymore. And that's a big problem that we the people need to deal with. But we can't deal with it until we get into power. Once we the people get into power and take control of both the judicial and the political realms, which is our right, our heritage, that is government by consent, through the juries and through the committeemen. Once we could do that, then we can correct the problems with this 17th Amendment. We could make it real easy with them, to show the point that the 17th Amendment was never ratified. So we could just go there and it's over with. Got it done, gone, finished. Okay? The other thing, though, is the states are no longer free. Between the 16th and the 17th Amendment, the slaves have been enslaved by the federal government and the people have been enslaved by the federal government. Then we have all those construction of law that is fraud that we're dealing with all the time in the courts. But that's where it's at. We are no longer a free people because we've been, ultimately incarcerated in a statutory prison. And the states have absolutely no say on what goes on in Washington because they don't control the senators. Where do they have their equal suffrage? And equal suffrage means equal vote. Where is their equal suffrage? Where is their equal vote in the Senate? And the Constitution, Article 5, requires that they have an equal vote, that they have equal suffrage in the Senate. And without that, they cannot be a free society. They do not participate in anything to say what goes on. And now I see this big movement. I've seen this movement actually going for a long time, but it always raises its ugly face from time to time, and it's just recently now because of the way the last election went, which may not be true, but, you know, the idea that Clinton had got the popular vote. But, you know, Trump was elected by the states. He had over 30 states, so he had the state vote. And the states elect the president, and that's the important point. The states elect the president. But in the states, and the states do a few things, you know, a few states here or there do things a little different, but nevertheless, it's still the same. The states have given to the people, the popular vote of the people in the state, to apply the electoral votes, you know, to this candidate or to that candidate as a whole. But there are a couple of states that I think that they can break up the electoral. Maybe they had 8 electoral votes and 4 can go here and 4 can go there or something. I don't know. I never really looked deep into that, but I heard that there are a couple of states that they do break it up. But generally speaking, the states take all of their votes towards the individual that the popular vote took place in that state. This was a very, very important part of a balance of power, because this was the big problem, or the big argument was that the states with the higher populations would control the election of the president constantly. All they have to do is create a party, like the Democratic Party, and seize control of the large populous areas, like the cities, Chicago, you know, New York City, you know, Los Angeles. If they can grab hold of the large numbers of cities, and they can control the election of the president all the time by popular vote. And that's part of their plan, in my opinion. And that's why every so often they keep bringing this thing up to get rid of the electoral. But it's very important that we continue to elect our president the way we do. It's a balance of power. But we have to return the power back to the states by getting rid of the 17th Amendment, which is null and void anyway. It's null and void for so many reasons. There's no way you can change the framework, the body, the balance of power, the Constitution, without an actual, you know, coming together in a convention. You can't do it through, you know, the states saying, yeah, after maybe the legislators propose it and they get a certain, I think it's 2/3 votes, and then it's got to be agreed to by the states, so on and so forth. In order to really change the balance of power, and you got to get together and discuss it and really create. Well, if we're going to destroy the balance of power, then what balance of power are we going to create that might be better? Of course, there is no argument for that. That debate has already taken place a couple of hundred years ago by our founding fathers. It's called Ultimately the Debate was recorded in the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. So, anyway, going back to this article, this paper, number 39, people need to go read this paper and particularly examine these particular paragraphs that we read tonight and, you know, think on these, meditate on these things a little bit, because it becomes so clear, this balance of power and what we are as a people, the unique government that we have, that no other has, no other nation has. And of course, we're a republic, and there is a lot of republics, but we're the only republic that has put God as the king of our republic, you know, that has put natural law as the centerpiece, and the people above the government, as we the people ordained and established. So therefore, you know, we are a very different republic, and that's the form of republic that is to be guaranteed. And that is no longer, we are no longer a republic in that sense, in the sense that 17th Amendment, the 16th and 17th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment has destroyed that. And we will talk about that, you know, in our course and also in the book we're putting together. Okay, I think that's all I have to share for this evening right now. Do we have any... announcements, Jan, or any questions?
Well, yeah. Last week, the prayer group came up, and it has been meeting at 9 o'clock on Tuesday evenings. and Doug Keller, who I think has been a plank holder in that group, I think he's there from the start, he has agreed to take it over and run it, so it will still be meeting at Tuesday night at 9.
Well, I'd like to talk with him before we continue on that, and, you know, I was very comfortable with Gary because I knew Gary, and he understood that we had to be very careful in a prayer group not to have it being taken over by people to begin with, to get lost in strange doctrines and different things. We need to stay on the very focused principles of the Bible. So try to set a meeting up between him and me, and let's make sure we adhere to sound doctrine in prayer.
Okay. We are now at 1,048 grand jury administrators, so we're only short about 14,000. So we need more grand jury administrators. Now, our special meeting last Wednesday, we picked up 13 volunteers to help make calls. That's an impressive number compared to the number we've been able to garner over the last year or so, say. We still need some volunteers to staff a committee to arrange interviews for John and Gerard by the news media and so on. And we're still looking for speakers for the natural healing call. Anyone who would like to give a 35 to 45 minute talk on any form of natural healing that they know about, or if they know someone who is in the natural healing business and they would like to give us a talk, we would love to hear what they have to say. And if you find one or know of one, just email me or give me a call. Email Jan.
And that's run like TED. You know, people come up. Anybody can come up if they
right.
want to talk for their one time, and
yep.
that's it. And they can come talk 2 or 3 weeks. You know, that's fine, too. But,
right.
You know, we want to make that point. We want people who have some knowledge to share that knowledge concerning health. But go ahead.
Right. And some people we've had do 2 or 3 sessions just to cover everything that they had in mind. You don't have to even be a member of NLA. If you're a practitioner, we'd love to hear from you. You ready for some questions? I have a couple. I'm not sure how they'll go.
Yeah, I guess. Let me think.
The first.
Before you go, hold on. Let me just think. Oh, okay. I just want to make this one point. You said that we got 13 volunteers out of the people
right.
that came together.
Right.
I'm surprised that we didn't get more than that. I was hopeful to get more than that because we had a lot of people show up
yep.
that night. But hopefully one of the big focuses of these 13 people as they make contact with other members of National Liberty Alliance is to try to reel them in to volunteer a little bit. Everybody should be working on this. If we don't grow, if we don't educate ourselves, if we don't communicate and organize and plan, you know, people don't plan to fail. They fail to plan. I forget where I heard that. My son found that somewhere years ago, and I remember him saying that, and it really stuck on me. People don't plan to fail. They fail to plan. We need to plan. This is a time of planning. This is a time of educating. This is a time of preparing. And we're running out of time. So we really need to pull the people in. People need to get involved. They need to get educated, and they need to volunteer a little time. Even if it's, let's say, well, I can only give you 1 hour a month. We'll live with that. We can live with that. Like to see 1 hour a week minimum. That's what I'd like to see, 1 hour a week minimum. And those who can give more, to give more. So please, everybody, if you want to volunteer your time and, you know, we can work things out on what it is that you can do, take our time to work things out of things that we need to get done and certain things, you know, a person might feel that they could do this better than that. So, you know, we can pick and choose. So nobody should be forced into doing something that they're not comfortable of being able to do or whatever. But, you know, that's one of the reasons why on these phone calls I suggested that two people get on a phone to call one person. This way you get two people working through this process and as teamwork and spend just a little bit of time with the person trying to reactivate them or get them activated or introduce them or welcome them into National Liberty Alliance. All right, I guess we're ready for questions.
Okay, if you recall, about a month ago, we had someone on who was a plaintiff in a case, and she was to be deposed. And the deposition lasted about 9.5 hours. Well, turns out the defense attorney decided she didn't answer all of her questions, so she filed a motion to sanction her for $6,970. So a question for you and Brent is, can they do that, and what are the comebacks? What might you do to negate that?
Interesting question. Brent, you want to comment on that? I don't have much knowledge of those things yet.
I see Brent's here. Let me unmute him.
I heard you say that they sanctioned this gal for $6,000-some. Is that right?
They're trying to, yeah. The case comes up in a week or so, I guess. $6,970 they want.
And for what exactly did she do that's not right? What did
they
say she did?
She said they didn't answer, or she didn't answer all of the questions asked her during the deposition. It's lasted about 9.5 hours.
The question is, can they do it? Yeah, the judge can do anything the judge wants to do. That's pretty much the practicality of it. Doesn't make it right, but that's a fact. And if people don't like it, they can appeal it. That's the sad news about the situation. And if you don't pay the fee, if the person doesn't pay the fee and the judge doesn't back off, then the judge can throw them in jail for contempt for not paying the fee until they pay it. That's just generally the kind of things that happen. But, of course, you want to go into court and argue against it. And what you have to do is find cases, find a case in the jurisdiction you're in. I didn't hear you say whether it's a federal or state court. What did you say?
I'm not sure which it was, Brent.
Okay. Well, it doesn't matter. Whichever court it is, if it's in a state court, you need a Supreme Court case from that state that talks about that kind of thing or gives an opinion on that kind of a question where somebody's sanctioned for not answering questions. Were the questions, did it say whether the questions were not answered while the lady was on the witness stand, or was it in a set of interrogatories?
I assumed it was while she was on the stand.
Okay, now here's the way that generally, well, did she not answer it? Does it say whether she didn't answer because she said she was taking the Fifth Amendment?
No, she did not say whether that was the case or not.
All these questions make a big difference as to...
Right, that was
the
position
law.
I was thinking. Good.
Yeah.
I think she's on the call law. Tonight, if we can unmute her, maybe.
Oh, okay. Well, if it is a matter of the Fifth Amendment, and she didn't want to answer the questions because she believed that it would put her in prosecutorial danger, and that's a standard that's generally used. Will it put you in prosecutorial danger? If the judge is convinced it will, if you can convince the judge that it will, then you're entitled to not answer the question. But you never...
She was in a regular deposition.
Was in a deposition. I see.
Yes.
Well, if it's
in
a deposition...
Federal court.
Yeah, in federal court. If it's in a deposition, the same rules pertaining to the Fifth Amendment would apply. The one thing you can't do and get away with it, never take what the law calls a blanket fifth. Never say, I'm not answering any questions. Now, you can say that when you're talking to a police officer, but once you get on the witness stand, a blanket fifth will get you in trouble for contempt. You say this, you say, no, I will listen to every question that's asked, I'll consider it, and decide whether or not I think I should answer it. That's the way you take the fifth on the stand. You don't just say, I'm taking the fifth. There is no blanket fifth allowed. When you take the oath to answer, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, that's tempered by your option to listen to each question individually and decide whether you want to answer. In other words, when you take the oath, you're not taking a blanket oath. You're taking an oath to answer the question, each one of them, as they're delivered to you. And if you decide, again, I'm repeating myself, but it stresses repeating and bears it. If you listen to each question and decide whether or not it puts you in real prosecutorial danger, and if you believe it does, then our Constitution of the United States and the state constitutions, and with common law jurisdiction, that the common law protection, you're entitled, and I'll answer the question. And you have to say so on the witness stand. And when you're in deposition, you're on the witness stand, even though you may be sitting at a table in a conference room someplace. It's the witness stand. You're under oath. You're answering questions. But to add one other thing, in depositions, traditionally, the scope of questioning is much broader because the judge is not there. So discovery allows a whole lot of questions. But, again, the Fifth Amendment is available if you're under oath. If you're under oath, to sum it up, if you're under oath, whether in deposition or in court, you are entitled to listen to each question individually and take the Fifth or don't take the Fifth as to each question. But you're not entitled in any event to just broadly say, I'm not answering any questions if you're under oath. If you're not under oath, in other words, you're down at the police station or your station, or you're talking to an officer of the government, an FBI agent or a tax agent or something, in your home or at the IRS office, you can say, I'm not talking. But when you say that, now, since the last few years, you have to say something like, I take the Fifth, or I invoke the protection of the Fifth, or I invoke the right to remain silent. It's not enough just to say nothing anymore. The courts have said you've got to verbally reference the right to remain silent.
Yeah, and I'd like to make a point that I know a little bit on this, and not much, but I'm aware of a couple of United States Supreme Court decisions that said that the Fifth applies both to criminal and civil cases. Now, in common law, there's no difference between the two in the sense that, you know, this isn't a criminal court here and a civil court there. It's just a court of law, period. And unfortunately, we are stuck in civil/criminal courts, which are statutory controlled and therefore a violation of our unalienable rights, putting us in subjection to being obedient to a government which we do not have to be obedient to. It's not their job to control our behavior. So that's a couple of things I would be thinking of, is looking into the United States Supreme Court for a couple of rulings. I can find you a couple of those. And focusing in on the Fifth was my thinking too, because that makes sense. And once you look at those two things, that's it. Now, is there any way that she can correct this now at this point? I do know, by the way, in the courts, and this is something I just recently learned and we exercised recently, instead of appealing a case, you can ask for a reconsideration, and there's two choices. That reconsideration could be by a panel of judges or by the judge that made the original decision. Obviously, you don't want to choose the judge that made the original decision. So if the judge goes in a way that you don't want him to go, and you can appeal it to the panel. And I would imagine at that point, Brent can tell us how this might work, mechanically, so to speak. But at that point, the case would have to sit and wait until that decision, the panels make a decision on that, so the case can continue forward. Would that be how that would work?
I see what's going on now.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought up these rulings about the Fifth Amendment applies in both criminal and non-criminal cases. The Fifth Amendment applies anywhere you are under oath. You could be sitting at an IRS agent's office, and he'll put you under oath to ask you where your assets are, and the Fifth Amendment may apply to any of those questions. That's a popular misconception among lawyers. I've been in conferences with lawyers, and you say that to a lawyer who's been practicing for 30 years, and they'll say that's not true. And the reason they say that, it's not true that it applies in civil, non-criminal cases. And the reason they say that is because it seems like a common sense question, and they never face the problem. But no, you're absolutely correct, John. And if you go to the library at some courthouse someplace or a Supreme Court building or something in the state where you live, you'll find treatises on the contempt in federal courts. And the law is unsure, it's unclear. And we can't always tell, but we know this, that the federal courts have what some people call formidable power, contempt. And they're the rulers of their own contempt powers. And when they throw you in jail for contempt, that means maybe for example, not answering a question, the judge says you're not entitled to take the Fifth off. They'll throw you in jail as long as your contempt isn't criminal, and in this case, it's not criminal. Criminal contempt is where you show contempt to the judge in the judge's presence. You tell him off, give him a cussing, whatever. That's criminal contempt, and you can be tried for that in a separate trial. And
I think the only time a person cannot claim the Fifth is if they have a duty to speak, and that's the key, and that's my opinion at this point from everything I can see. If they have a duty to speak, then they have to speak. They cannot not speak. So if they're a person, let's say they're an elected or appointed individual or an individual that's employed by the government, they have certain powers and authority, and if it's connected to their powers and authority and they're asked the question, they have a duty to speak. And if they don't speak, then I believe that they should be able to be held in contempt of court. Now, the other thing with this contempt of court thing the fact that you don't answer. If you don't answer something, let's say it's a civil case, I refuse to answer under the grounds that I might incriminate myself. Now, not answering a question that was sworn to maybe on the other side in a way that's favorable to them, if they swore to that something in their affidavit, and if that's not rebutted by the questioning that you're being asked, the penalty for not answering is the loss of that position. In other words, the truth would be held to the person who has the affidavit, which would rule the court. That affidavit would rule that court, and there would be the penalty for the person for not answering in a civil case.
Yes,
and that's my thinking anyway.
Yeah, and it is the federal judge, he decides whether or not you're entitled to, whether you have to talk. And if he says you're not in real prosecutorial danger, then he might say, well, then you have to talk and you're going to be held in contempt if you don't. Now, in this particular case, but here's the other thing, too. It's good to be compelled. If you don't want to talk and you're compelled under force or threat of force of a federal judge, that creates a different situation, too. If you take the Fifth and he says you're not entitled to it, and still he makes you talk or throws you in jail. Now, you remember Susan McDougal. It was a classic case. Susan McDougal and the Whitewater scandal of the Clinton administration. She was ordered finally to talk. And she said, well, I don't care what you say. I'm not going to do it. But always remind you, be careful. Do not commit criminal contempt. You can say ugly things about the judge outside of the courtroom, but don't do it to his face. That's criminal. Now, if you don't answer a question, you do it respectfully. Well, I believe that'll incriminate me. The judge says, well, it won't. If I'm ordering you to answer, you say, well, in all due respect, judge, I disagree, and I'm not going to answer. And then he says, okay, well, I'm going to throw you in jail, but remember, I'm going to put the courthouse key in your pocket. Well, what do you mean, judge? Well, that means all you have to do to get out of jail is tell me you'll answer the question. Just send word to me, and I'll let you out immediately. And that's not a criminal matter. It doesn't go on your record traditionally in a common law jurisdiction. And as far as I know, there's no statutes on the books that says one way or the other. But traditionally, and by custom, the limit is 6 months in prison. Now, I think Susan McDougal, somebody can go look, I think she was there for 18 months. 6 months is the custom. 18 months is the absolute limit for non-criminal contempts. 18 months in prison. That's a long time. But what the judge is doing, it's that gray area where you have a disagreement. You have a fundamental right to not to talk or not to talk. And you have a judge that disagrees whether you're entitled, because if you're under oath, you have a duty to help in our courts. If you have information, for example, the Constitution says if somebody's under criminal prosecution, they have the right to compel witnesses in their favor, even if you don't want to come. They can subpoena you, and you can be forced to come and testify. Now, the only way to get out of that is if you believe your answers will put you under real prosecutorial danger. I keep repeating that phrase. That's the one the courts use. But we all have a duty to help if we're able. That's, by the way, what it means to defend our Constitution against all enemies domestic. That means we're willing to go into court and serve as a witness, serve as a juryman, whatever we're asked to do, as much as within us lies. And that's the duty of every person to do that, unless, again, they're under real prosecutorial danger. Back to you, John.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I guess we'll move on to our next question.
Okay, I'm not sure about this one, whether it's something you're knowledgeable on, but it deals with unemployment tax on escorts in the state of New Hampshire. You want me to read it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm currently dealing with the state of New Hampshire in an issue where they are requiring me to pay unemployment tax for my solely owned and run S Corporation. I'm trying to prove that, one, I don't meet the definition of employing unit under the requirements in their RSAs, as all my services are performed outside of the state. They then declare that I'm an American employee under their RSAs, which uses United States in the definition. They're
Did we lose you? Did we lose Jan, Terry? Or did I get lost? Can anyone hear me?
So.
Okay.
I don't.
I hear you, John.
He has had some problems. He's been kicked off 3 times, so he'll be back shortly, I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah, I had problems last week being kicked off of the platform here, but not the audio. So, I see, Gerard, you don't have a mic today. If you got a mic, give us a yell. If not, then I guess you can't tell us. Okay. All right, we'll give him a moment or two to see if he comes up, back up, and then we'll continue on. Looking to see what else I might have here while we're waiting. Take a quick look at. All right, I don't really have anything particular. All right, what we'll do is we'll move on to Brent, and then we'll come back to Q's questions that have been sent in after Brent. So let's move over to Brent. We're going to go to Brent Winters. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. Let me unmute him, maybe. Good, try it. Try it again. Try it, Brent.
Okay, can you hear
me
now?
We got you.
Oh,
yep.
Okay. Boy, this has been, I don't even, hang on just a minute. I'll see if I can get up and running.
It looks like
here.
I was unmuting you, and you were probably unmuting yourself at the same time.
Yeah,
the check came off and on.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, we're going to talk about the Constitution. As always, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to do so, and also my comments are my own, and I don't profess them to be anybody else that's on this call, but this is some of my gathered thoughts on the Constitution of the United States, Section 8, Clause 2 of Article 1. Remember, Article 1 addresses matters concerning the Congress of the United States, and that's the longest article, and that's the one we're in right now. And it says here in this particular Section 8, Clause 2, it says that Congress shall have the power to borrow money. And, of course, that's a big problem, to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Now, the power of Congress to borrow money on the credit of the United States means to borrow money on the credit on the backs of individual Americans. That's what that means. Because, of course, government doesn't have any money. The only way government gets money, they don't earn it. No, they take it at the point of a gun or a blackjack, force or threat of force. And that's what taxes are. Remember, too, as we said before, taxes aren't debts. There is no contract there. That's a myth to say there is. No, taxes are obligations, and there's a difference between an obligation at law and a debt. a debt, that means contract. Show me a debt, I'll show you a contract. Show me a contract, I'll show you a debt. That's what contract is. You didn't contract with the government, you just live here. You live here, and because you live here, the government says you got to pay. And the question is, have they followed the proper process that the common law gives us by means of the words of our Constitution? Well, the power of Congress to borrow money on the credit of the United States, but that's what we're talking about here. And it's important to remember in all this that the borrower, in this case Congress, enslaves the individual American to the lender, that is the bankers. Let me repeat that. When the Congress borrows money, Congress enslaves the individual American to the lender. That means the banker. Now remember again, this is all a ruse of words, because we're talking here about usury, crying out loud. Usury, which in Europe and in England was called for centuries the scourge of all mankind. And the reason for that is because even Jesus Christ cites the law of God, saying usury is against the law. And we see in the historic books of the Old Testament that even 1% usury is condemned as unlawful, because the law, as it was given in the first five books of the Bible, condemns usury. What is usury? Usury is not lending of money. If you lend something, it's called lending. It isn't. The banks don't lend money. Hear me close on this. The banks, to lend something means you get it back. But the banks, when they give money, they don't get it back. It's spent. As a matter of fact, it's given to the person called the borrower, who is not the borrower. He didn't borrow anything. He doesn't give the money back. He spends it. The Bible, for example, the laws of nature's God, as the Declaration of 76 terms the Bible, the Bible says that there are two things that are not to be given on interest, on a surcharge, food and money. And what's the reason? Because those two items are given for the purpose of being consumed. Consumed. And you either spend the money or you eat the food. And it was against the law in our early existence as a people, even before our separation from Britain. I think I'd mentioned this before. I read a case that occurred in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It went before the courts. It was a criminal case where the lieutenant governor of the colony was prosecuted for loaning, or giving, not a loan. Again, he's not going to get it back. He gave 10 bushels of corn to another man who needed it to help him get through the rest of the winter. And he did it under a contract that the man would pay him back 12 bushels of corn. Well, that's usury. That's a consumable item. Food and money, usually that's the only consumable item that's given like that. And that's why the Bible forbids the giving of food and money with a surcharge, because it's given to be consumed. Well, he was prosecuted because usury was against the law in America. Why was it against the law in America? Because it's always been against the law, common law. Why is it against the law, common law? Because the Bible, Jesus Christ himself, affirms that usury is evil. And where there's usury, all the money will migrate into the hands of a single will over time. And the user understands that. That's why when you go into little towns, no matter how bad all things are in America, you go into little towns, notice what the nice business buildings are. There are always two nice business buildings. Even in big town, the biggest building in the city is the major bank building. In small towns, the nicest building is just the bank building. Of course, the drug business is bigger than it's ever been in America, and the drug stores, Walgreens and all, they've got the nicest buildings in little towns too. But drugs and money, that's where we are today. More drug use in America today, it's said to be legal. There's more in America today than there ever has been. Look back to this lender thing. So the borrower is slave to the lender. Both of those words are misnomers, but we don't have any other words to say it. So he's enslaved. That's Proverbs chapter 22, verse 7. Slave. It means to worship another by one's labor. That's what a slave does. A slave has no rights against the user, ultimately. History speaks clear. The same banker using debt will readily enslave nations at war with each other. I bought an old Mercedes-Benz years ago. It was a 1979, and I liked it. It was a four-speed diesel, and I liked the diesel, and I liked the little four-speed motor, and I liked the stick shift, and I was excited about it. My father, who was not a young man, but he was in the war in the Pacific, and he got good at working on these big diesel motors, and I had a diesel motor. I wanted to show it to him. I drove down to the house, and I opened the hood, and he's looking around over it. And of course, it was old enough that you could see a lot of the road underneath of it. We used to say a vehicle's worth more. You can gauge what it's really worth by how much pavement you can see when you open the hood. That means it hadn't got too much junk on it, too many computer parts and all that. Well, that's the way this thing was, and Dad got to looking at it. And he said, well, I'll be. I said, what is it? He said, that pump there. He said, that pump on the side of the motor, that's made by the same company that made the pumps on those big diesel motors that they put in those amphibious ships in the Pacific. And I said, well, that's a German company, Dad. He said, yeah, that's a German company. Of course, Mercedes is a German car, German built. And I said, let me get this straight. We're at war with Germany, and you're telling me that the pumps on these motors were made in Germany, and we're at war with Germany. He said, yeah, they were a brand-new little craft that was built and all. And I said, well, that stands to reason. I guess that's the way it works. And people that make money, bankers being among them, they don't care who's fighting who or who gets killed. They just want to make money. They'll loan to both sides and keep the war going if they can. That's what usury is. It's an evil craft, and it is a... it's a tool of warfare, according to the Old Testament. In other words, it's okay to loan to your enemy, but it's not okay to loan to your fellow countrymen. Section 8, Clause 3, it says that the Congress, this is the Constitution of the United States, Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Indian tribes. Now, it doesn't say Native American tribes. Why? Because nobody ever heard of such a thing. And that's the way our Constitution talks, and we need to say it that way so we're clear when we talk about this what the law is in America. This is the Commerce Clause, Section 8, Clause 3. This is the clause that's said to grant more power to Congress than any clause in the Constitution. It is said among lawyers that Congress is king of the Commerce Clause. There is hardly anything that goes on in America under jurisdiction and the laws, the statutes of Congress, that they don't do it and claim jurisdiction to do it under this one little old clause here of the Constitution. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 15 words. And Congress claims to be able to do anything they want to do under this clause because of them. And they say, well, there's nothing that goes on in America that doesn't affect commerce between the states. And to give you the idea, this is a famous case, famous in the sense that I remember what it's about, famous in the sense that I don't remember the names of books that I like, but I remember the authors. Well, I remember what the name, what this case was about. It occurred, it came to the Supreme Court during World War II is about a farmer that lived in Nebraska, and he was feeding his cows. He's feeding his cattle grain, and all the grain that he was feeding his cattle, he raised right there on his own land, and he took it in, he harvested it, took it to the hammer mill, hammered it out in the ground feed, and fed it to his cattle. And I don't remember all the details of the case, but what it came down to is this. Of course, that was during the days of Roosevelt and the New Deal, and the massive interference in people's lives against the law by regulatory schemes that were regulations or really statutes the president's bureaucracies passed. And, of course, at that time, Roosevelt claimed all the power that he wanted to regulate the production of agricultural products. And they claim to be able to have the power to do it under the Commerce Clause, under this clause right here of the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. Matter of fact, all of the New Deal and all of the intrusions we suffer today, the massive intrusions that began during the reign, the tyrannical reign of Roosevelt, all of them, almost all of them, fall under these 15 or so words here. Claiming the power. Everything is commerce. Everything is economics. We have the power to control all economics. Well, they said to this farmer, we have the power to tell you how many cattle you can raise and how much land you can farm. We have the power to tell you to do that. He said, no, you don't. They said, why? Because I'm not involved in interstate commerce. You're claiming you have the power to do these things, to have the regulatory commissions of the railroad, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Wabash Valley Authority that goes from state to state, damming up water across state lines. You claim the Columbia Valley Authority and the Columbia River. You claim all this. I have nothing to do with interstate commerce. I'm just a farmer here in Nebraska, and I mind my own business, and I stay in my own state. I've never even traveled outside the state. I don't ship any products I grow on my farm outside the state. I don't even allow those products into the stream of commerce. I don't sell them locally and put them in the stream of commerce where they may be shipped back to Chicago, for example, and shipped overseas. And that, by the way, is one of the ways that that the courts, the federal courts, have said that activities can be brought under the Commerce Clause. For example, if I sell you my garden produce, I put it in the stream of commerce. You may take it and go across the state line and give it or sell it or distribute it to somebody else. That's what the courts say. But this guy wasn't even doing that. He was feeding all his stuff right there and butchering his own cattle, eating them himself. Well, it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court of the United States, now under the tyranny of the Roosevelt administration, who threatened to, of course, attack the court if the court didn't do what they told them to do. Can you imagine? If you don't do what we say, we're going to make you do what the president says. Well, the court was kowtowing to Roosevelt. And Roosevelt, of course, was just a useful idiot for the bankers. That's all that amounted to. So the Supreme Court said, well, it may be true that you're not putting your products in the stream of commerce, Mr. Farmer. It may be true that you're consuming everything that you grow right there on your own farm. It may be true that you're consuming your cattle or consuming the grain right there on your own farm. And then you're taking your cattle and you're butchering themselves yourselves and eating them. But because you do those things, then you don't have to go down to the grocery store for the market and buy other products to eat. You're eating it yourself. So that, you see, affects, A-F-F-E-C-T. It doesn't affect interstate commerce. It's much more slight than that. It just affects it. You affect interstate commerce. Because if you weren't doing these things, you'd be buying products that were in the stream of interstate commerce that were produced in other states, food and whatnot, grain. And so, yeah, what you're doing does come under the power of Congress and anything they want to do and the power of the president and anything he wants to do under the Commerce Clause. That's what the court said. That's madness. Did the people that ratified the Constitution of the United States intend that? No. They wasn't in the remotest thinking. Well, then how did the court justify saying that? Because they abandoned. They utterly abandoned what had been the rule of interpretation of law, statutes and constitutions, written law, the rule of interpretation that had prevailed as far back as you can go in mankind. Even Jesus Christ himself showed us, as did Paul the Apostle in the New Testament, that this is the principle of interpretation. For example, in other words, then the principle is this. I didn't even say what it was. Originality, original intent. Justice Scalia made it famous. What did the people intended that actually wrote and ratified this? When Jesus Christ, for instance, this is an example of original intent. Jesus Christ was confronted by the Judaics, the distractors, the Babylonian adherents, the votaries of Babylonian Judaism. And they said, well, what about this and what about that? What about the man, or the man that married a woman, or the woman that married a man and he died, and then if she married another man, he died, and then she married another man and he died. And this goes on seven times, not quite Henry VIII, but seven times. And then they said, who will be your husband in the next world? And he said, you err, not knowing the scriptures. You don't even know the Bible. That's your problem number one. It says that he's the God of the living, not the God of the dead. And not only that, on the other side, in the other world, men will not be given in marriage. There will be no marriage of men and women. That's all that happens over there. And then he said also of marriage in another context. They were asking him about it, and he went back to the law, the Torah of God, and he went back to original intent. And he said, from the beginning, and listen to this, he said, from the beginning, yes, when the law was given, it was not intended the way you said it should be. We don't care what you think it should be. What we care about is what was intended by those that wrote it, or the one that wrote it. That's what's important, and we follow that hermeneutic, that interpretation principle of our Constitution of the United States, because it is the only tethering device we have. As Justice Scalia said, clearly said, he said, if you don't accept and practice originalism, when you interpret the Constitution of the United States, originalism meaning original intent, what did the writers and the ratifiers in our country mean when they ratified the Constitution? If you don't follow that, it's just a free-for-all. You're floating aimlessly on a sea of subjectivity. Whatever you want at the moment becomes the law. Is it any wonder now that that has prevailed for a long time? Well, since World War II, since the 1930s, really, that has been the prevailing force. Well, we know it says this, and we know it intended that, but here's what we need right now, so we're going to say it means this. I'm tempted to say words that are not I shouldn't say in mixed company when I think of the utter idiocy and stupidity of men that are educated beyond their intelligence, and going to Harvard Law School and Stanford and saying things like that and believing it and pushing it and falling prey to it. And then the rest of the country cheering them on. Men and women, a Constitution of the United States, they say the Constitution of the United States says men and women ought to be married. Men and women. Men and men can be married. Did the framers have that in their minds? No, they're just making it up as they go. That sounds like fun. Let's try that. That's not law, friends, neighbors, and kin. And when that becomes the standard, we have nothing to rely upon and trust and to plan for the future. We don't have anything to hang on that we'll not hang on to that does not change, or we're made to think we don't. Truth is we do. Don't ever forget we do. A true law never changes in its principle. And we can hang on to that. We can believe in that. Our God, the true lawgiver, his principles don't change because he doesn't change. Well, that's the Commerce Clause is being abused that way, of course. Government uses the Commerce Clause as a license to unlimited power instead of a bar on government power. That's the real intent of our Constitution, is to bar government power, not give license to government power. That turns the whole Constitution upside down. Because the courts refuse to limit Congress's reach, as the Commerce Clause requires, law schools nowadays teach that Congress has unlimited power in America to do whatever they want. But it's beyond that. It's worse than that. It's the President of the United States doing whatever he wants and doing it under the rubric of the Commerce Clause. The framers, however, meant instead for this clause to empower Congress to keep the states from hampering free flow of goods and services and people to and from other countries, to and from the Indian tribes, to and from and between the states of the United States themselves. And any act of Congress beyond this is unconstitutional. It is lawless, for instance. Now, this is just an example, and I'm not taking a position one way or the other. But to say, for example, as Congress has said, And this was a case that went before the Congress, or before the Supreme Court of the United States back in the 1930s. And it had to do with transportation of milk across state lines. And some milk companies were filling milk. You know, Borden Milk Company. I forget which ones there were, Prairie Farm, whatever it was. They were putting fillers in milk, oils that would give them more milk, and they could sell it for more because it had stuff in it that cut it, made it less milk and more of something else. And Congress said, we have the power to stop that. They passed a law said that, or they could either stop it or make it happen. I can't remember what it was. That's not the important point. The important point is they said we have the power to regulate milk. What kind of milk crosses state lines? Well, if they have the power to regulate what kind of milk crosses state lines in commerce, that's a power to limit commerce, not to encourage commerce. The kinds of cases they've decided have, in a lot of cases, hampered. You know, when the Bible makes the same point in principle. But when the Constitution of the United States uses the word regulate, for example, this clause, to regulate commerce, what does regulate mean? Slow it down? No. The word is also used in the same root word is used in the Second Amendment to our Constitution. A militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people, no, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, a well-regulated militia. What does regulate mean there? What does it mean here in the Commerce Clause? It's used a couple of times in the Constitution. But what it means is regulate means to flow freely, constantly, and nonstop. To be free and constant and nonstop. Regulate. Something that's regulated is steady. It doesn't stop. And it's consistent in its activity. That's what this word means in both cases. Regulate commerce, that means to make sure commerce is free-flowing. It's not to be used, this power of Congress is not to be used to slow down commerce, to keep things from happening. Well, it's important about the word regulate. Any act of Congress beyond this is unconstitutional. In fact, to regulate, says James Madison, means to keep regular. That is, to keep constant streams of commerce flowing across state lines. I remember, military men sometimes talk and they say, well, there's the regular Navy and then there's the reserves. There's the regular Army and then there's the reserves. Well, what's the difference? Again, the word regulate. The regular Army and the regular Navy, that means that they are constant, they're always on duty, they're consistent, they never stop. That's regular Army, that's regular Navy. The reserves, by distinction, are not regular. No, they're irregular. They just meet once a month. And you never know if they're going to be ready. Matter of fact, they aren't ready. Now, they're not ready like the regular Army and Navy, but that's the difference, just to illustrate the word again. The word commerce, it says here to regulate commerce. Commerce was new and fresh when our Constitution was drafted. According to the first edition of Encyclopedia Britannica, of the year 1776, the year our country started. By the way, the Encyclopedia Britannica, that was the first edition published, was in the year 1776, and it was in three volumes. And in that edition of Encyclopedia Britannica, which, by the way, arose out of Scotland, out of the Scottish Enlightenment, commerce, says Encyclopedia Britannica, means tangible goods, never services, and evidences of transactions such as communications by documents and communication by electric or light signal. That's what Encyclopedia Britannica says. So the word services is not here. And I had said up here, and I'd said wrongly probably, because 1776 has a long article on, or the Encyclopedia Britannica of 1776 has a long article on commerce, and it says it only refers to tangible goods and never services. Never evidences of transactions. That means commercial paper, notes, checks, bank notes, Federal Reserve notes, not included in this. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court interprets Congress to mean not only trade between the states, but also all kinds of commercial and non-commercial activity wholly occurring within the boundaries of each of the individual states. That's what the Supreme Court says. Even if it stays within the states, it's mind-boggling the senselessness of what educated men do. Now, there are some men that are formally educated that use the tools they've been given wisely. But I would say it's the exception more than the rule. I really have seen that. I'm convinced of it. Commerce among the several states, that means interstate commerce, says the Supreme Court, includes not only movement and transactions across state lines, but also any activity that never moves or extends across a state boundary, but that affects, there's that word again, A-F-F-E-C-T, affects, by the word affect with an A, is a term of emotion. And even the courts say, and I've been in courts and listened to judges say this, ruling on things, they say that it even includes things that could affect, but doesn't and hasn't, commerce in another state. If you do something in one state and it's possible that it could affect commerce in another state, it comes under the Commerce Clause. I've heard federal district court judges say that. That's why I say it here. So even non-activity, you see, is said to affect interstate commerce. If you just sit in one place and do nothing and never involve yourself in anything, the courts will say, well, because you did nothing, if you've done something, that would have had a different effect. You did nothing, that has a certain effect also. Such silly interpretation is destructive. Men and women languish in jails and prisons due to such absurd overreaching of Congress-made crimes, taking power where a person's action or inaction could affect someone's emotions. That's really what they're saying. There are people in the federal prisons because it was said that I was involved in a case. It went to federal court. It was a criminal case. It had to do with extortion. And the people that were accused of the extortion were trying to get their money back that was stolen from them. The money was stolen from them. They were trying to get it back. Lots of money, upwards of $30,000. They were trying to get it back. And they were trying to serve process on this fellow. And an altercation occurred. And he didn't even have the money. They were trying, they said, you committed extortion. And we proved that this fellow didn't even have the money they were trying to get back. He'd spent it, wasted it. But they still said that the federal government, by their statutes, had a jurisdiction over the case under the Interstate Commerce Clause, even though it wasn't even possible to how you extort money from a person that doesn't even have the money. All this confusion. And what it boils down to is they just want, the courts just say, we just want the federal government to do whatever they want to be able to do. We don't want to stop them. That's limitless power to meddle with commerce. It includes the power to fine and punish, to encourage and promote, protect and prohibit, and even to restrain and destroy. Thus, Congress passes laws and provides funds to control farmland and livestock, to forbid interstate shipment of otherwise lawful goods. That's hampering commerce, not helping it, not regulating it, not keeping it freely flowing. In short, the general government in Washington, D.C., that means all three branches, misuses the Commerce Clause to hamper and even stop interstate commerce instead of to regulate it, that is, to keep it moving steadily back and forth across state lines and to foreign countries. Nowadays, Congress even bars shipment of certain items between states and to other countries in order to manipulate prices of those products. The Commerce Clause is, yes, go ahead.
May I interrupt you for a second?
It's your mic. Go ahead.
Okay. I've got to get off and get to bed, but I wanted to let you know that I had bought that book that you had, The Militia of the Several States.
Yes.
And wonderful book. I mean, just wonderful.
That's encouraging to hear. Go ahead.
No, I mean, without a doubt. Especially halfway through the book, I got into the last part of it last night and read through it. And like I said, just amazing. I was so impressed with the biblical portion that you put into it. And again, like I said, I need to hit the sack, but I wanted to thank you for publishing the book. I am going to purchase a few more to dispense out. And then I also wanted to make a comment to John that, you know, I got on the – this is the first time I've got on the call. I'm a part of the Texan Jewel Society, and I'm a clerk for the Texan Jewel Society. So, therefore, my time is occupied on Thursday night, so I can't get on. But I made it a point to get on tonight. Just to hear what John had to say, and then also to listen to you. So I'm again impressed with what you've written. Plan on getting on the next book, or my next book that I'm going to get from you is the Declaration of 1776, because it references to this book of the Militia of the Several States. But
yes.
To also make a comment to John that I had wholeheartedly agree with him that it's knowledge that is needed within our population, and it's going to be only through the knowledge that we are able to achieve our ultimate goal. So hats off to everyone. I continue to do what I'm going to do. I'll try to get on to the NLA call on Monday nights as much as possible, but look forward to hearing from all of you.
Well, thank you. That's encouraging words. We appreciate it. John, are you still there?
Yep. Yeah. Thank you from us too. Appreciate that. Yeah.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah.
Well, John,
I've got a business to run, so I've got to hit the sack. You know, being in Texas, it's 10 o'clock, and I got to get up early and head out. But like I said, I've been a part of the Texan Jewel Society since 2011, and I'm a major part of it. I just can't shake it. I believe in the cause, but at the same time, being a part of that, it doesn't allow me to get involved in other things on the same night because not only am I the clerk, but I'm the moderator for that call. So I get the call started, I move the call through, and we move forward. But John, I was so impressed with you tonight and what you said, and the fact, you know, we opened with a prayer. And when you made a comment why you didn't open with a prayer and what you did open with, just like I said, I got goosebumps because, I mean, it just that's what we need. that's what we need.
Do you have a website?
If you go to, republickeepers.com. You'll find information on us. That is our website. I do not keep it maintained. There's another gentleman that does that, so I don't know where we're at, but as far as updating it. But there's documents on there that you'll see that we have written to our Texas government, and I've been a party to that. Like I said, again, you know, this is all about everybody collectively doing their part, and I firmly believe that that John, you are most definitely an asset, and judicially, Brent, I've heard so many good things from you. A good friend of mine had turned me on to you here several months ago whenever he told me about the Excellence of Law book that you had written. Now, unfortunately, I hadn't had an opportunity to purchase that book yet, and at this point, I don't know that I am, not for any other reason than the fact that you're referencing the militia of the several states to the Declaration, your book, The Declaration of 1776. So, therefore, I definitely want to get that book and go through that one and see it. But did comment, Mr. Winters, about the Federalist Papers.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody and everybody needs to know those Federalist Papers.
Mm-hmm. Are, is I your mean, friend from East Texas by any chance?
I'm sorry, do what?
Is your friend from East Texas around Tyler? You mentioned a friend that...
Yeah, yeah.
Why, okay, I just wonder. I think I know who it is, but I'm not sure.
I know you.
I'll find
it. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the call and the comments. That's encouraging.
Now, we've spoken several times and several times about you, and I've been a part of the, as much as I hate to say, I've been a part of the NLA for a number of years, but haven't been a participant in the NLA simply because it has been in conflict with my time for being the clerk for the Jewell Society. So it's not in any disrespect to the NLA, but at the same time, you know, I've got an obligation here, and I can't step, you know, aside. So I just want that to be understood.
Appreciate
right, well, we appreciate that. Thank you for the call. And just a quick note that, you know, we do upload the MP3s for Monday night meetings, so anybody who can't stay the whole, you know, 3 hours, and the only reason we're 3 hours long is to accommodate people on the West Coast. I mean, because at, you know, midnight for us is like 9 o'clock for them. We start at 9 o'clock Eastern time. So for them, it's like 6 o'clock. A lot of these people are heading home from work and eating dinner. So they missed right. The first hour or so. And so that's why we decided, well, we'll meet at 9. It's not too late for the East Coast, and it brings the West Coast in.
Right.
Unfortunately, a lot of the good stuff, I think, really takes place in the beginning of our program, the first hour or two, you know, where we try to focus in on a subject matter or discuss a specific thing. And then, of course, Brent comes on and does some teaching. So, you know, that, in my opinion, is the meat of what we're doing. But also as important is the Q&A time where people can ask any questions, you can comment, and, of course, there's an education there. So, anyway, if you do want to pick up and catch up on, you know, the meetings, but you can't be here, they are recorded and they're up on Monday night page for download.
Well, I'll definitely do so, John, and I'll try to get on the Monday nights now that I know that you actually are working, you know, on the Monday nights. Our only time is a Thursday night, so that's really it on that. As far as, like I was saying earlier, as far as the Federalist Papers, I think, you know, God has got such a big part in this country. And I'll tell you, that's why I think I love that book. I mean, it's such a small book, that Militia for the Several States. So denotes, the godliness in our country. And it just amazes me. So, like I said, I think that we're lacking that in our country, but I've seen over the years how it is moving in a positive manner, and I do believe that it's because of people like you, Brent, and you, John, and groups like the one I'm in, and we just need to keep hammering it, and hopefully we'll come together and we will be victorious. I can't help but believe that.
Well, amen. And after all, we are restoring, you know, the king back into the court, which is God back into our courts, into the courts of justice. And but a couple of things, you know, the Federalist Papers, I've got a breakdown which will be in the book, and we'll probably post it up online too, maybe near the Federalist Papers, which tells you each one of these different, documents, okay? Each one of these documents, what they're focused in on. If they're focused in particularly on a particular Article 1, Section 9, whatever the case may be, you know, and gives you the information. So that makes it a little easier, and especially if you're reading the Constitution and it's unclear on the meaning there, you can kind of look down the list on the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, and you can see, oh, this would cover that particular discussion, and let's see what our founders had to say about this and what the final solution or interpretation of this was. And so that's one thing that's extremely important. I think people should utilize that. The other thing is the militia. You brought up the militia. You know, once we, the people, take back control and we take back our courts by building our administrations and getting the people in control of dealing with the juries and not allowing political animals to, you know, have access to them without being watched by the people to know that they don't violate the juries. But once we get to that point and we get the committeemen back under the power of the people, we can evaluate our counties and figure out what's going on. Where is our armory? How come we don't have an armory anymore? And how can we have access to army? What is the proper role of the militia in our state and within our and what is available in our counties? So we should kind of reevaluate the status and of the militia, you know, in our own states and in our own counties, and make sure that proper availability is there in our counties and being able to participate, to know how to participate, especially in the unorganized militia. How does that work, and how can we participate and even get involved in the militia itself? But anyway, these are things we have to look at as a people and reconsider and try to figure out what we need to do.
Right, yeah, exactly. Brent actually explains that extremely well in that book when he discusses how the militia has various parts in it. Your part in the militia as far as in the military, let me rephrase that, not military, but the armed portion of it, but you're also a party to the grand jury and the petit jury. So you're not only part of the on hands, on the ground, but you're also in the judicial.
Right.
And it's not.
Yeah, but we got to make sure that they aren't abused and that they have a proper orientation and they understand the jurisdiction of the court that they sit in. Because
right.
If they're sitting in a criminal or a civil court, they're sitting in a statutory process that may be on the federal level controlled by USC 18 and whatever state laws might control on the state level for a particular violation of law or whatever the case may be. A jury in those circumstances are tied down, and people don't realize that they're really not in a court of law. They kind of think they are, and even the judges may even think that they are, especially on the state level. But the truth of the matter is they have to be unadulterated. They have to have the power and the authority of jury nullification, and they need to be told that, okay? They need to be orientated properly and not evaluated so that they can do a psychological on them and use them in the proper, in whatever cases it is they want to use this group or that group in order to get the end results that they want, because unfortunately it is that bad and that's what they do. So we got to fix these problems.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I said, I'm going to go ahead and exit the call tonight, but
thank you
both for being on, and anyone else that's on tonight listening. Fantastic. Just love it. Look forward to next Monday.
Okay, thank you. Back to you, Brent.
God bless.
You too. Godspeed.
Hey, guys, this is Steel Rain over here in Western North Carolina.
Yeah, hang on one second. Hang on one second. Let Brent finish up, and then we'll take Q&A.
Yeah. Just a minute.
Matter of fact,
I haven't got much more. Go ahead.
That's it.
Yeah, go ahead, Brent.
Okay. The Commerce Clause is to further the root reason for our Constitution. Of course, every part of the Constitution is for that. All comes back to its root reason. That is to limit the federal government. That's the root reason of the Constitution of the United States. There is no higher reason, no other reason. everything in it bends to that direction and undergirds the idea of limiting the power, ultimately and first and foremost, of the general government in Washington, D.C. One must therefore never interpret it to give unlimited power to that government. That's what's happening. Swallowing up the whole purpose of our Constitution, that is happening now. To sum up, contrary to fundamental rights and in violation of federalism, our Constitution is distribution of authority between the states and the general government. By this, Congress lays false claim to authority to hamper movement of everything from people and livestock to firearms and grain, not only among the states but within each state. The other two branches of government, ignoring our Constitution, enforce this lawlessness of the acts of Congress. Well, that's all I had tonight, John, if that's enough. And again, appreciate the opportunity.
Appreciate that. All right, before we go over to taking calls, I see Steel Rain, I think it was, coming in on a VoIP dialer wants to talk. I'm going to move over to the queue. So, Steele, you might want to hit star 6 as soon as I do that, and you'll be the first one into the queue. But we do want to finish up with one other thing before we take questions. It shouldn't take too much longer. But let me move over to Q&A. So if you hit star 6 and then 1, you'll get into the queue, and then anybody else that wants to get into the queue, star 6 and 1 to get into the queue. And we'll take it from there. Before we ask, and I see Steele's in already, anybody else wants to get into the queue, go right ahead. Jan, are you back in?
For the moment, yep.
Okay. You want to pick up where you were so rudely interrupted?
Yeah. Blessed Verizon did it to me.
Yeah.
Again. Okay, I'll start from the beginning just in case you forgot. This pertains to the state of New Hampshire, and they're requiring this fellow to pay unemployment tax. He's a sole owner and runs an S-Corp. So his first question is, I don't meet the definition of employing unit. Under the requirements in their RSAs, as all my services are performed outside of the state, they then declared that I'm an American employee, under which their RSAs uses United States in the definition. They're misrepresenting their own RSAs, and I'm trying to make the argument that I'm not an American employee because I do not reside in the United States. Also, how can there be an employee when the definition
Where does he reside? Does he say where he resides if he's not in the U.S.?
Well, he obviously resides in New Hampshire.
Okay, that's what I thought. And then he's...
Yeah.
You see, that's not a good argument, but go ahead, because he does reside in the United States. And the United States, you know, by reading what we read in Federalist Paper number 39, kind of answered that. We are both federal and national. And so there is a federal government and there is a national, you know, nationalist as far as being national, being part of your state, a society on its own, and collectively we are together. It's a very unique union that our founding fathers came up with. But anyway, go ahead, continue.
Also, how can there be an employee when the definition of employing unit is not met, thus there being no business technically to be an employee for?
Well, look, he's making the wrong argument. The argument should be is I just don't have any employees. If he's a subchapter S, means that he can act in a certain fashion, and get certain benefits, and as long as he has less than a certain number of employees. But nevertheless, if you're taking out money out of your company and you're not paying yourself as an employee, which you shouldn't be, and you're the only one in it, there is no employees. There's nothing to talk about. Now, the unfortunate thing is these people don't want to hear it. And especially if you rub them the wrong way, they get these vendettas. They gotta get you. They gotta come after you, because you gave them a hard time. Who are you to question our authority? We are the kings here. You are not the king. You know, the servants have taken over the house. That's the problem. Now, I have a lot of experience in this because one of the ways I got involved in studying law, not at the time, immediately after, but sometime after, you know, because of some problems, one with this, with the dealing with unemployment, and the other one dealing with the IRS. And then eventually, you know, we started studying law mostly because we needed to deal with the problem with the committeemen. But nevertheless, it's something that did build up and was a problem. I went through that process, and I fought with these people tooth and nail. They are evil and ugly people. They don't care about nothing. And the more you push back, the more angry they get, and the venom comes out. And they want to put you in jail if they could. They actually think that they can. Now, here in New York, I have found that they're a paper tiger. They're not going to put you in jail, nor do they have the power or the authority. But even the monies that they try to collect off of you, even that can become a problem for their collection. You know, usually the collection comes through fear, mostly in people fear. But, you know, there could be other legal mechanisms that they use that it works for them, and they can come and just take your money. But here's what I found, and again, you know, I'm really upset with lawyers for lots of things in my past, and even the way that a lot of them are these days, of course, what I know. But, you know, I was fighting this battle, and I refused to participate in their administrative process and so on and so forth, which is, an administrative courtroom, really. You know, the guy plays the judge, and the whole thing is stacked against you. Everybody in the room works for the government, and they're all up against you. How can you possibly win? It's like going to a traffic court. You know, the cop is in the game. He's a political animal, ultimately, because he works for the government. And the judge is a political animal. He works for the government. The prosecutor, if there is one, he works for the government. And there's little old you, little old me, sitting there against all of this power. And the judge is going to take the absolute authority. Whatever that cop says, that's what happened. And there's no way you can win. It's a lose-lose scenario over and over and over again. These administrative processes are the same way. Okay, could be the same thing. They could be beneficial to people who want to participate in the process, and don't give them a hard time and try to apply their rules and regs. If they want to play that game, they're welcome to do it. And you can win some righteous cases, I'm sure, and make some good arguments, appeal the bad decisions, and get things done. I'm sure all that can happen. But when you tell them I'm not part of the game and I didn't sign up for it, boy, do they get their backs all arched up. Now, I was going to go through the administrative process. I was trying to figure out what to do, and I didn't know much about the law back then. And so I did call a lawyer, and I did pay a lawyer to come in one time with me to make an argument. And he said to me, you know, before we went into that, he says, look, go into the administrative battle, make the battle, and if you lose, you can always go through the appeal system. He told me I couldn't get into a regular court without going through that process. So I went through the process, and I did, of course, lose, because you can't win there, especially if you upset them. They get their backs arched, you're done. They just want you. I went through that whole process. I did, of course, lose, and then I went to appeal it. That's when I found out you can't appeal those cases in administrative court once you've gone through them unless you first satisfy the penalty against you. And they wanted, I don't know, many thousands of dollars from me. So I just ignored them, told them to go to Hades, and that was that. And nothing ever came of it. They never came to any collecting. They threatened me many times, you know, but it never went anywhere. Now, what I would say, I would not deal with that problem the way I dealt with in the past, because I dealt out of ignorance. Number one, you can just let them know, my corporation has no employees. I'm the only individual at this point in time, and when I have some employees and I want to participate, I'll give you a call. Thank you very much. But you got to do this in writing, number one. And if they annoy you and harass you, then you got to lay out the law to them and what it is that they're doing to you and how they're injuring you. There's an 8-point process to do what's called a notice and demand. And I believe it's 8 points. You should be able to find it on our website. You can find it on Bill Thornton's website. Even if you just Google it, you know, notice and demand, you'll get some ideas. But look for Thornton lays out the points that need to be covered in a notice and demand. And I know we do that too on our site. And, you know, with writing the book and the course and everything else, we're going to be covering notice and demands, and we'll make sure we have the most latest thing up there and lay out how to do it. So what you do is you do a notice and demand, you do certified, and you do the notice demand in a in an affidavit form. So at the end of the paper, you want to sign it under sworn affidavit, as a sworn affidavit. And up the top, you're going to want to put the, you know, whatever county you live in, New York, the three little curves, and then SS sworn statement up on the top. And then on the bottom, you have the notary thing, a place for them to sign. And the notice and demand must fulfill the points and must tell them what you're going to do if they don't obey, okay? And but before you do the notice and demand, you want to get back and forth communications to see what their positions are, what they're thinking of, what they're claiming against you, what their, you got to know what their position is so you can defend yourself from whatever it is that they're saying, okay? And that's when the notice and demand comes out. If they continue, you correct that, and they continue to harass you because they don't accept the correction, and they will not because they're not thinkers. They only do, they're mechanical people. They just respond to the next step, form number 1, 3, 4, 6, 12, and so on. You know, you want to follow that process. Whenever you're dealing with any government agency, dealing with anything legal, lawful, in any way, shape, or form, but anytime you're dealing with the government, no matter what level it is, judicial level or political level, it doesn't matter. You want to respond to them. Do not not respond, because in law, you acquiesce when you don't respond. Most people get in trouble with the IRS, and they come upon you quickly, is because you don't respond to their papers. They're setting you up. And if you look, there's a form number. And the next time they correspond with you, it takes the next step in the next form number. Look down, usually it's down on the bottom right-hand side, form number 1046A, 1046B, 1010, whatever it is. And so you'll see it's a process, and they're getting you to agree to them by acquiescing. Okay, they'll even send you, when it gets close to the end, they'll give you the opportunity to come and participate in their administrative process. You know, this is how you can solve the problem. You come in, we're going to have a meeting, we'll have someone decide. An arbitration, they're calling it, I think, an arbitrator. Well, you better respond to that because you acquiesce to it if you don't. And then once you lose by acquiescing, then at certain points, you know, it's a countdown of time, next 30 days, next 30 days, next 30 days. Once you get to that point, though, now you've agreed that you're guilty. You've agreed to the number, and now they're going to come out after you in a different fashion for enforcement. And depending on the administration, you know, most administrations don't have that much power to come out after the people. The IRS is the only one that has their own courtroom. They got their own judges. They got the whole day. Nobody gives them a hard time. They don't pay any heed to the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a major problem for that. But IRS, you better respond. Anybody else, you need to respond. And then you have to bring it to the point after some communications and some corrections and some questions. Well, I don't understand that. How did you get to this? And you see, if they're not explaining these things, they're not. You're going to see it in the paperwork. You're building a case by communicating with them to understand who they are, what they want, and what they're trying to get out of you. Okay? Once you understand and it becomes harassment, then you've straightened it out and you've laid it out clearly that, you know, this is not true for me. I don't fall into this category. I have no employees, et cetera, et cetera. This is my company. You might take profits out of it. It's none of their business. I wouldn't even bring that up. But you're not employed. You don't get a paycheck from your company. And there is nobody at this point in time. When that happens, I'll give you a call. Thank you very much. You see, once you lay that out and they continue to harass you, but you get the picture of what it is they're harassing you and what their points are, now you could do your notice and demand because you know exactly what to focus into, you know exactly what to deny, you know exactly what to require them to respond to. And if they don't respond, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take control of you. And the whole thing is laid out. So like I said, Bill Thornton has a really good one, and we've taken his and enhanced it a little bit, but it's on our website. You'll have to search it out. Probably it'll be under education probably. Okay, once you go through that notice and demand process, okay, and they continue to come out after you, okay, that's when you're going to have to deal with it in a different way. In administrative, if they try to get you into administrative court, I got to believe that there is a number. And, in other words, they got to serve you with some kind of paper, and they have an index number of some kind, and you can use that and move it into federal court for cause. Okay? I'd have to think about how. Once you do the notice and demand, where to go from there, unless you're going to have to pay the fee, and that's a problem because it takes you out of the common law side of the court. I'm trying to work on that problem right now by recreating a different kind of a form. And we'll talk more about that as soon as we get it done, but we will get that done soon, and then we're going to test that court case by using a form that brings us into a different jurisdiction, which is not their jurisdiction, but the jurisdiction under law. And we'll see how that goes. They're going to buck it, and it's going to be an uphill battle. Don't know whether we can win it as we move along. In the long run, I think we can win it in our lawsuit against the judiciary, which I haven't gotten back to yet, but we need to get back to that. But we got to work with this other stuff first. That is where we'll bring all of these things up when we sue the judiciary. And that's going to be a little bit interesting how we're going to go about approaching that and the paperwork when it's going to be used in order to open those courts, because we want to make sure we open a court of record. I got to think a little more on where to go to after the notice and demand, and it depends on what they do after. Definitely you could take it and move it into the court, into your local state court, the court of record, state court in your county. I would not move it into a county court. I'd move it into the state court, and what you're doing is you're going there to enforce the lack of responding of the notice and demand, but you're going to have to pay the fee. Here in New York, it's $310. It's $210 for the let me think which is which. I think it's $210 for the index number and $95 for the so it's $305. $95 for the judicial I forget what that's called. It's called an RJI, Request of Judicial, I forget what the I is, interference maybe, but no. In any event, you're requesting a judge. I never fill that part out. I just do the RJI, make my case on paper because that's all I'm interested in. And if the other side wants to go pay that, they'll pay it. I don't care. But once you're into the court, you're making the position, you're doing a show cause. You want to show cause at a couple of things, concerning you want to bring up your notice and demand and all the paperwork that led up to that. Try to keep it as short as possible, but orderly, and, put your numbers on each one of your different documents. A, B, C, or 1, 2, 3, whatever. You laid in court and do a show cause on why a judgment shouldn't be taken against them. And your judgment should end up being, ultimately, your wherefore clause is the cease and desist. You may want to chase them for a little bit of money, but cease and desist. I always ask for the money that they're chasing me for. You want to chase me for $10,000? Well, then that's what I'm going to chase you back for. And it's kind of my rule of thumb. But they are chasing you for a specific amount, I'm sure, because they're sending you bills. And remember, you don't respond to those bills and tell them they're an error, they don't belong to me, blah, 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 blah. You acquiesce to them. So you got to respond. Don't let anything go by, and keep your records good, keep them in order, keep them in a folder separate from anything else, and make it simple and easy, chronological order, so you can go through your case and continue to build upon it. So that's one way to do it. Now, if the state court gives you, they go status quo on you, which they probably will, okay, that's fine. Then you move it to federal court for cause. There's no charge for that. Because you already got an index number in the state, and you move it back to another court for cause, there's no charge to move into another court for cause. Then through that, if he sticks the status quo, and they will, if they think that you don't know enough, they will probably stick the status quo. If you worry them because they don't know, you know too much, they feel, and they're not sure of your knowledge, they'll try to get rid of the case. But if you get lost in that, the next step is to move it to reconsideration by a panel of judges. That could be good. And then if that doesn't work, you then have the appeal. And in some, like New York, I understand, we got some new judges down there, so there's a good chance in our appeals we're going to get some common law decisions. And so it could work out for us. But that's the process, and that's what you can do, and that's how I would approach it. But once you do your notice and demand, they may leave you alone. There's a possibility they'll stop at that point. But you got to make everything sworn statements, affidavit, very official looking. You got to really do some nice documents, keep it nice and pretty, put out a nice a heading to this, and so on. Okay, any other questions before we move to our next caller?
Yeah, there is a second question. Further, they are a corporation under the United States Corporation and not operating as one of the 50 states of the Union. Hence their lack of oath of office and bond. I'm trying to find a way to show their incorporation.
Once you go into the corporation, they own you.
Okay.
That's their game. That's commercial. That's their game. We've given them power and authority. Even though they abuse that, we're giving them power and authority. I've always operated under DBA. There's a few other things I do, but I've done, but I'm not going to say that over the air. And, you know, if they want to play the game, I can play the game too. But I would do a DBA, and but again, if you're a chapter S or any corporation that doesn't have any employees yet, you're in a different mode. You can tell them you're not ready for employees. When you're ready, you let them know. What more can they do to you there? You know, but you got to do this on affidavits and everything. And, you know, and it is true, employees ultimately identify with people who work for the government. But, and as far as the man on the land stuff, I'd stay far away from that because you're not going to win with that. They're laughing at you, and they already know at the end of the day they're going to win because there's no way you can make any case worthwhile that'll stand, you know? It's just you're not going to get it. But anyway, what else?
Nope, that was the end of it.
We lost our caller. We only had one other caller in the queue. If anybody's got a question or a comment, star six and then one to get into the queue. So questions we're taking right now. Or comments, if you got a comment. Meanwhile, I'm looking for something to talk about if we don't have a caller. Well, we got James. Let me unmute him. James, you got the mic. Go right ahead. What's that, Georgia?
Yes, it's in Georgia. Anyhow, I've come across I go to church, and let's just say that a lot of the churches I've been to, Romans chapter 13 has three verses. I don't know if you've come across this or not, but once they get to the obey authority part, they kind of leave it and stop there.
Mm-hmm.
As I read further, I love the beauty of Romans chapter 13 and its balance. And I was just wondering if you have any comments about that, if you've ever done a Bible study on that I can go back in the archives and look at, because, you know, it's just beautiful to me. Hey, it's balanced.
Okay, well, Romans chapter 13 deals with honor and authority. I'm opening my book here to it now, and it says, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God." And then, you know, there's maybe we'll read a little more, but before we read a little more, I want to make certain points. You know, I had a really good Bible teacher for many, many years of my life. He's passed some years back, but he taught me a lot. But even and he was probably one of the greatest Bible teachers I've heard anywhere ever, whether reading books, reading studies, listening to preachers, teachers, and so on and so forth. This guy was, you know, heads and shoulders over them all. He just was really a blessed teacher. And in any event, he had some errors, which I didn't pick up in the beginning. You know, being a student and as time goes on and spending time in the Bible, but as years gone by, you know, I saw some errors here or there, and just like I must have some errors, everybody's got errors. That's the key to this whole thing. But one of his positions was that our founding fathers was in disobedience to God because they weren't obedient to the powers that be. But when you really go back and look, numerous things. Number one, the devil had taken over and was violating the rights, the unalienable rights of all people, especially here in the colonies, of course. And they just become so evil and dictatorship type thing. You know, they were tyrants. But the other thing is, and I was just finding this out just recently, that we really didn't have any strong connection that they really had authority over the colonies ultimately. They just took control and the people kind of just went along with it. You could call that acquiesce, but that's fine. But I think the Declaration of Independence answers this whole problem here, you know, concerning the violation as an evil tyrant and the violation of the law. When the government breaks the law, okay, and we're talking about the natural law, when the government breaks the law, it's no government at all. Now, even in the Declaration of Independence, it says, you know, you have to have some really, you know, strong positions and points in order to want to break away from a government that is. But it's possible, it can be done. And so we just returned back to the natural law where we should be, okay, we as a people should be. And I do believe, with all my heart and soul, that if our founding fathers, if we're paying for the sins of our fathers as much as anything else, you know, and our founding fathers, as blessed as they were, as godly as they were, as righteous as they were, when they played around with this slave thing and didn't fix it, and Jefferson said it's going to come and bite you and it's going to get you, God's justice is not going to rest, okay, that's why we have gone through all of this stuff with the New World Order and the deep state, and all of this assault upon our liberties and degrading of our liberties, deterioration of our liberties, and all of the pains and sufferings we're going through, because we're paying for that sin. I truly believe that. But we have repented from that. We have changed from that. We need to acknowledge that and move on and really truly bend the knee to the king of the court, which is God. Did you want to make another comment? Do you want me to read a little more on this or what?
Well, the two points that really jumped out at me in the chapter is the purpose of the sword.
Mm-hmm.
Right there is a very specific purpose. It's not for, you know, some sort of general purpose. It is a very specific purpose for the sword that was given. You know, not social engineering,
well, bear in mind,
not picking winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing like that. And the other point, when you
is
get to verse 10...
Is this where it says that they do not bear the sword in vain? I'm looking for the verse here in chapter...
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
you know,
they bear it for a purpose.
Right. Bear in mind, though, okay, bear in mind, the spiritual understanding of the word sword in the Bible, and we have an example of this when Christ was being captured to be taken to be crucified, and Peter picked up the sword. Prior to that, you know, he said, you know, to bring a sword, and he said, I got a sword. Peter says, I got a sword. And he says, enough. The point was he was talking about the word of God. It's a two-edged sword. That's the ultimate thing. And when a nation that is righteous, you see, I believe that we have the right to really rebel against a nation that is not under the law of God. And difficult thing to do, okay? I think being in America, we're in one of the few places in the United States have the ability to do it, and there's still enough there that we can, you know, get a hold of and use and trust that we're going to get through it. But anyway, what verse is that on the sword?
I can't recall off the top of my head. It's around five or six, something like that. That to me was very telling. Because having that specific purpose for the sword, not some general purpose, really was a restriction on the power of the state, of the power of the rulers at that time, that, you know, a lot of people may not want
still,
to think about.
It's still for today, too. Look at, you know, one of the key things I think we really have to appreciate when looking at chapter 13 in Romans here is to understand and appreciate that God says he brings up governments and he brings them down. And he'll bring up one. He'll bring up a nation. And it could be an evil nation in order to bring judgment against the people. After all, he did that with Babylon against his own people, the Jews. You know, they were disobedient, and it got to the point where God just brought that judgment upon them. Okay, and again, we're no different, and that's why I think we as Americans have run through this. But the verse you're thinking of, I'll start in 3. It's 3 and 4. For the rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to do thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So God does use governments to bring down other governments, uses for judgment. And if you're living under a government that is statutory and you don't have the natural law, and if you obey their rules and don't give them a hard time, because you don't know anything else anyway, you know, you'll be okay, and for good or for bad, but ultimately you'll be okay. And I think that's part of what this is saying also. But, you know, as the 13 colonies, going back to that, remember, they believed that they were under the common law. They believed they had unalienable rights. And this king...
Yeah, but exercised those rights for a long time.
Huh?
They had exercised those rights for a long time.
That's right. And when they discovered that this evil prince, devil incarnated maybe, you know, was doing what he was doing, and it was so terrible, the rebellion was really a proper act, and to cut them off. But also, if you go back in, they never really had the authority over the... They just came in and took it. The people just kind of went along with it. They didn't necessarily agree, but they didn't disagree. You could say they acquiesced, or you can say, well, they realized they had a need for a formal government, and maybe this would work okay for us, so we'll live under the rules, you know? But nevertheless, when evil takes control, it's a whole different story. We have a duty, as a matter of fact, under this nation, because we have a constitution, a Declaration of Independence, which we have an agreement with God over this. So, we have a pact with God, and so we have a duty to protect God being the ruler of the court, the judge of the court, so therefore he's the king. We have a duty to protect not only our own rights, but the rights of others and of our posterity and so on. So,
yes, we have all sorts of obligations and responsibilities, mm-hmm. but that's part of being an adult.
Okay. All right. Let me see. I know there was another call, and we lost him again. I don't know if he wants to get back.
Enjoy it when you get to verse 10.
I'm sorry? Oh, verse 10?
Yes. When I read that, I thought of the NLA.
Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Well, yeah. The two great commandments, love God and love your neighbor. Those are the two commandments. You know that.
Okay.
It's impossible for you to break the law if you do those two things. Because if
that must be a slightly different interpretation, because the one I had was more along the lines of a King James, where it's like doing no, do no injury to your neighbor and fulfill the law.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, let's see.
That's why I was asking about the Bible study, actually getting back into the Greek to see exactly what this was saying.
Well, I think
all right, have a good evening.
I think it is saying what it says in English, though, because, you know, I don't know that I've ever looked at this in the Greek, in this case, in Romans. But love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. And so love can do no ill, okay? And since love can do no ill, you can't break the law if you're loving your neighbor and you're loving God. You just cannot break the law. You know, just think about it. You have to injure your neighbor. You have to do something wrong to them, and that's not loving them. You're not gonna. If you steal from them, you're not loving them. You know, and so on. What are you gonna add? Whatever evil you want to add to that. All right. Thanks, James.
That brings up the question: can you break the law if you do no ill?
Well, if you do no ill, you're not breaking the law, but the bottom line is we'll all break the law. There's no one that could live a life without breaking the law. And usually we're sinning against God, and not necessarily, we sin against other people too, but if we could work that one out, but we sin against God every time we're disobedient to him. You know, God has statutes. He has laws and he has statutes. Laws are meant that all are to follow, and we're to execute those laws in a court of law. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and so on. They're written in the hearts of men. But then there are statutes, okay? You know, remember the Sabbath day. Yeah. Keep it holy. That's a statute.
The civil law.
We can't require other men to obey that. But we ourselves must obey that. If we're a Christian, we have to obey that. You know? So there's other statutes. Honor your mother and your father, okay? And everyone should do that. But a lot of people don't honor their parents. And they're dishonorable to them, and even if they're adults or whatever. But you can't put a person, you can't go in, take a person, bring them in a court of law because they're not honoring their parents, you know. Again, though, but for you and me, if we're Christians, we have to honor our parents. And there's where we break a lot of things. And we always got to look for, constantly be in a humble position in repentance. Okay. Close to the end, there was another caller. I don't see him. If he wants to come back in, or if anybody else wants to get in, we've got a couple more minutes. If not, we'll end.
1 minute.
1 minute. We're left to 1 minute. And there's no other questions out there from you, Jan, right?
Nope, nothing at all.
Okay. Well, usually we go over a few minutes. Yeah. All right. I guess we will end our program 30 seconds earlier, and we'll be back next Monday, Lord willing, and we'll see what's happening then. And again, I'm working diligently last couple of days now, and I'm going to continue every moment I can to get Chapter 7 done and move along. I do have a lot of the work done after Chapter 7, a matter of putting it together, cleaning it up, and putting it into some kind of order. So hopefully once I get past Chapter 7, it might move a little quicker. But 7 is going to take me a little while. I can see it's going to take me a couple of weeks at least, maybe a month. I don't know. It's going to take a little while. So a lot involved in that. Okay. Good night. Thanks, everyone, for coming.